Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, friends and neighbors. So good to see you here on the Bill Press Pod. Well, my, how times have changed for the worst. Not so long ago, when we heard talk of dangerous right-wing extremist groups, it was all about members of small militia enclaves up in the mountains of Idaho that none of us would probably ever encounter. But no longer, not after Donald Trump has brought them into the mainstream. In Charlottesville, he praised right-wing extremists as very fine people. In response to the Black Lives Matter protest last summer, Trump encouraged groups like the Proud Boys to stage their own riots in Detroit and Portland and other cities. And on January 6th, he summoned a mob of armed and dangerous extremists to Washington to invade the U.S. Capitol and put the lives of the vice president and every member of Congress at risk. In the age of Donald Trump, right-wing extremists are no longer rare and remote. They are many, they are dangerous, and they are everywhere. In fact, just this week, the Southern Poverty Law Center identified 838 active hate groups that they are tracking across the United States. To learn more about the danger they pose to all of us, we hooked up with Michael Edison Hayden, the center's senior investigative reporter and spokesperson. Michael, thank you so much for joining us here on the Bill Press Pod. Good to talk to you. I have to tell you to open that ever since I've been in journalism, the Southern Poverty Law Center has been the one organization that we all depend on for your tracking of extremist organizations around the country. My impression is that there are more of them than ever before. Am I right? If so, how many are you tracking and where are they?
We are publishing this week our updated Year in Hate map. And there's actually slight decreases in the total number of hate groups. But I don't think that that should really serve as cause for celebration, especially given the environment that we're in now and what we saw on January 6th. It's complicated. If you look at what happened on January 6th, there were anti-government groups like the Oath Keepers there and Nick Fuentes's America First Coalition, which is a white nationalist group. But what we saw in Charlottesville back in 2017, where there was all these guys with specific uniform shields and things like that, it was slightly different. There was a huge mix of people who had just been radicalized online, individually, alone, at their computers, mixed in with all these traditional kind of anti-government groups and white nationalist groups. And that kind of stew is what we're kind of facing right now as a country.
The last time I looked at your website, it was 2019. You had said you were following 940 hate groups. So what you're telling us is that there are fewer of those now. But I always thought of these as like militias up in the foothills of Idaho. Looking at your map, that's not the case. They're all over the country, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Part of the evolution of the Southern Poverty Law Center has been to begin looking at hate groups, extremist groups, far-right groups. This is not something that is relegated to people who want to perpetuate the Confederacy only, you know, down south. This is something, you know, starting in Trump's run in 2015, we saw this huge flare of extremist activity, neo-Nazi activity in the Rust Belt. And some of the most prominent far-right extremists of that Trump era were people from the North and the Northeast. I mean, I'm thinking of people like Andrew Anglin, who is the editor of the Daily Stormer, who is from Columbus, Ohio. And Michael Penovich, who started this podcast network called The Right Stuff that branched out into a number of different, I guess you would call them cells or little chapters across the country, and he's now founded a self-described political party called National Justice Party. I don't know if this is, you can qualify this as politics. It's just explicit desire to turn the country into a fascist state. But Penevich lived in New York City at times and was from New Jersey. And the degree to which it has been weaponized, and the algorithms, particularly the algorithms of social media companies, have been weaponized to radicalize people who you might stereotypically think are not part of this type of behavior.
Do you have a list of criteria that a group has to meet for you to identify them as a hate group? I mean, there is a line, right, between just being like a bunch of kooks, right, who have some crazy ideas to a group that has a specific agenda?
Well, first thing I would say is I would urge you to do a search for us and look for just the criteria of hate group and read the formal definition. I'm going to give you a casual definition here. And the casual definition is these are people who assemble, you know, in an adversarial way against people's immutable characteristics. By that, we mean just things that just they cannot change, how they were born. People who are born in another country and came to this country, for example. People who are born with a particular sexual preference. People who are born Black into Jewish families, etc. These immutable characteristics, the targeting of that is what we typically use to define a hate group, the opposition to it. I would note that, you know, there are all kinds of conversations happening among those who research far-right extremists about this kind of new wave of, I guess, hate, you would call it, that we're seeing in the country that is really about anti-democratic activism, hard-right authoritarian anti-democratic activism. And these are type of people who may allow for people of color to be in their group or may align themselves with Jewish people, for example, often in the service of promoting authoritarian anti-democratic regimes that, of course, disproportionately impact people of color in places like America, because you know, who hoards the power, who is not allowed to vote, et cetera. And these, you know, this phenomenon is a particularly like a real post-Trump issue, and it is, you know, something we're talking about a lot when we're kind of figuring out how to define academically what is happening.
What are the groups? Which are the of the groups are you most concerned about today in this post-Trump age? And in the age and in the wake of January 6th?
So I'll give you two answers there. Broadly speaking, the surge in anti-government activism in the aftermath of Trump's electoral defeat. That is a very, very huge matter that we're concerned about now. It's beginning to do a bleed over into the kind of white nationalists and neo-Nazi groups that or activists that admired Trump, at least in his early days, because now we're in a situation where the Democrats superficially have power, at least. When I say superficially, I mean it's certainly a tenuous hold right now in a very volatile political climate, as we all know from watching the news. But these neo-Nazi groups, I'm thinking of like Daily Stormer, for example, which is longstanding, have begun to also embrace the type of anti-government, anti-state rhetoric more readily that we would traditionally associate with anti-government militias. And that is spreading. If you remember, obviously, Timothy McVeigh in the 1990s, really, really strongly held anti-government beliefs, but also admirer of the Turner Diaries, this kind of white supremacist fantasy book involving, you know, hanging traitors and so forth, but with really strong racist and anti-Semitic overtones. That coming together of different kinds of far-right extremism is something that we're seeing a lot more of and something that I'm personally very concerned about. The second answer I was going to give you is merely the degree to which individual people, not in a group necessarily, but hooked onto encrypted messaging apps and even on very public-facing, prominent, highly trafficked websites like Twitter, are being radicalized over the internet. And that radicalization, I get a sense, is kind of growing in the aftermath of January 6th rather than slowing down.
Let me ask you specifically about some of the groups that we saw, people wearing their members, their leaders, people wearing their slogans and their gear on January 6th at the Capitol. Let's start with Proud Boys. How big are they? How dangerous are they?
Well, I don't know if you saw this story recently, but their de facto leader for going back for the last 2 years, Enrique Tarrio, was recently found to have been collaborating with the FBI for a while. So I don't know how that's going to impact the Proud Boys going forward. It's a little bit reminded me of the Sopranos, so to speak. I mean, I wonder what the level of trust is going to be in that group going forward. But, not to dismiss them, because the Proud Boys have been extraordinarily resilient. You know, there have been times their founder, Gavin McGinnis, who is Canadian, born Canadian, has tried to distance himself at several times from the Proud Boys because of the degree to which they've been inflicting violence around the country at all these different events, taking, these sort of street level brawls that have happened in New York and Portland and all these places. So Proud Boys, taking out this apparent FBI informant story, have chapters all across the country and have been extraordinarily adept at recruiting people from buckets where they may have white supremacist views, but they also may be people of color. And the kind of thing that brings them together is, again, what I mentioned before, this kind of anti-democratic, hard right. I mean, they would argue that they're pro-democracy. They're really trying to defend democracy, right? They love Trump during the height of the Trump era, and these hard right, authoritarian, neo-fascist image of this organized street group uniformed, going out there and fighting anti-Trump protesters, was, I think, really, really shocking. And they had a huge, obviously, boost in recruitment in the aftermath of Trump name-checking them at a debate, if you recall.
Right.
I believe it was towards the end of September. So I don't know what the informant story will do to impact them, but they've been extraordinarily resilient. And they really do feel like a very 21st century hate group, in the sense that they have members who have been white nationalists or connected to the white supremacist movement, but they also welcome in, people of color. And Tarrio was that.
How about the Oath Keepers?
So the Oath Keepers, our anti-government desk would be better at getting really deep into the Oath Keepers. But the Oath Keepers are one of the prominent anti-government extremist groups in the country. And I think what is so unnerving to people about the Oath Keepers is their ability to kind of assess a sort of first responders in situations like we saw on January 6th, their level of coordination, their interest in recruiting military personnel. They had a very pro-Trump bent and, apparently loaned out kind of in a security manner, people like Roger Stone, also the Proud Boys, Roger Stone, people who are connected to Trump. A lot of the groups that you saw on January 6th, for example, I think really have this kind of connection to the world of Republican politics, where they just have like one or two toes in there, in that they have people like Roger Stone, who is a phone call away from the president at the time, as far as everybody knows, even when he was let go as an advisor. And Stone has appeared in places with surrounded by Oath Keepers and surrounded mm-hmm. by Proud Boys as well. So, these kind of really, really pro-Trump groups. And we anticipate the Oath Keepers to take a more traditional anti-government view without Trump being around.
And are the three percenters in that same category?
Yes. Militia groups, very, very focused on kind of constitutional, defending their idea of the Constitution. One thing I like to talk about with people who don't really understand, how do you look at people who put the idea of patriotism and a patriot first? And what I would say is that these anti-government groups, which are like very, superficially pro-American and things like that, have definitions of patriotism that, like the three percenters and things like that, that you have to meet an extreme definition of patriotism, an extremist definition of patriotism, in order to satisfy their vision. So their beliefs in defending this sort of the Second Amendment, the First Amendment, and things like that in the Constitution are so extreme, only few people can meet it. And those who don't can be regarded as like enemies of the state. The philosophy professor from Yale, Jason Stanley, who's written a lot about fascism and how whether, Trump was a fascist and things like that. He's received a lot of criticism. I think he's been, a lot of his writing has been validated by recent events. But Jason Stanley talks about this friend-enemy distinction in fascist propaganda that really bleeds over into these anti-government groups. You don't have to be explicitly pro-fascist to have them. And by that means that either you're with the leader or you are an enemy. This is really, really eerily common among pro-Trump supporters, pro-Trump world these days. I think of former speechwriter for the White House, Darren Beatty, who will tweet about American citizens being the enemy, our enemy within, our enemy at home. And as just as a point of comparison, we who report on these far-right groups for Southern Poverty Law Center, when we have internal conversations, we're not like, oh, these people are enemies or something like that. We are doing research, academic assessments of these groups, of what they believe. These type of conversations are very specific to hardline extremist ideas, these ideas that you're either with the leader or against. Pretty scary stuff, actually.
Right. So what role has Donald Trump played in the emergence, the growth, the power, the presence of these extremist organizations?
It's a really good question. And I think it's one that historians will be better able to answer at some juncture.
But what have you seen?
Yes. But what we know for sure is that there's a huge increase in hate group activity and in far-right extremist recruitment from the minute that Trump came down that escalator in the spring, summer of 2015. Part of that is because Trump was giving voice to the same type of things that extremist groups were talking about. The type of rhetoric he was using about immigrants, the dehumanizing rhetoric that he was using about immigrants, the type of rhetoric he was using about Muslims that echoed so much of the anti-Muslim extremist groups, his willingness to bring in people like Stephen Miller, who had ties to VDER, which is a white nationalist group, Sebastian Gorka, who had connections to Act for America, which is an anti-Muslim hate group. We won't know the full impact of that, but it is extraordinarily substantial. And every day we have more evidence of the degree to which his rhetoric helped radicalize tons and tons and tons of people. But it's not just Trump. It's also the algorithms on Twitter and the degree to which Trump was given this massive platform and allowed to speak for very long time on television, just dehumanizing people and so forth. He was the president who won in a very slim margin, only in the Electoral College. But you look at people like Marjorie Taylor Greene, for example. She is, you know, the congresswoman from Georgia, she, you know, QAnon believer and stuff like that. This is a post-Trump extreme figure in our politics. And when I say that, if you look at somebody like Steve King, for example, who had these white nationalist beliefs, congressman from Iowa for many years, King kept trying to deny that he was a white nationalist and was sort of trying to work within Republican politics and be a normal kind of figure and denying these things and sort of teasing it out and going, Marjorie Taylor Greene is a sort of different animal altogether. This is a different variety. She says extreme things outright. She promotes extreme beliefs. She's willing to defend extreme beliefs. And there are very few people in the Republican Party, due to the degree to which Trump has helped radicalize that base of support, who are willing to disavow Green.
They were all present in some form, different numbers of members, but all of their regalia was seen and their signs and slogans, again, on January 6th. Did they organize together ahead of time to storm the Capitol, to take over the Capitol, to basically shut down the United States Congress?
We don't have enough time to talk about all this because we could do about 6 hours on this. But in the immediate aftermath of Trump losing that election, and I knew it, I could tell in his voice when he addressed the people at like, I don't remember, it was like 2 or 3 in the morning East Coast time that day. I could see in Trump's face the news he was getting was not good. From that moment, his social media supporters, prominent social media supporters who are operatives with ties to the Republican Party, people like this man, Ali Alexander, originally Ali Akbar, who is tied to the Proud Boys, you know, has a strong relationship with Gavin McGinnis, the founder of the Proud Boys. Ali Alexander started to push this Roger Stone hashtag called Stop the Steal and push it very aggressively on social media, along with other social media influencers who are connected to the Trump world. I'm thinking of people like Jack Posobiec of One America News. Sometimes we, mainstream media laughs at these people, wants to ignore them. They treat them as kind of fatuous and things like that. So a lot of people did not take this seriously. And Alexander started to promote a series of events. The first, really major one, I believe, was November 14th. I think it was a Saturday in Washington, D.C. But there were a few other ones. There were a few other ones that would pop up. Mike Cernovich, who was a social media influencer, came down from his home in California down to Maricopa County, for example, surrounded by anti-government people with who were armed, I believe. These Alexander Stop the Steal events had overt out there white nationalists. Nick Fuentes is one of them, a young white nationalist who has a big following. I believe I mentioned him earlier. And other extremist groups, including the Proud Boys. And Alexander, who is multiracial himself, in that sense, can provide a lot of cover for some of this extremism, started to make public statements about, we are not disavowing anyone in this movement. We're not disavowing anyone. Trump's margin for victory before, even long before that election, seemed just potential margin for victory seems so slim, if you recall. And I got the sense that there's just this unwillingness to disavow because they just needed every inch. If you remember that stand back and stand by comment with the Proud
Boys. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And we published a long investigation on Stephen Miller's emails in 2019. That was one of the first times someone associated with the Trump movement got outed in connection with white nationalism, and they did not make a comment. They didn't touch anything related to Stephen Miller. I got the sense that they were really closing the hatches here and not disavowing anyone. And Ali Alexander inherited this Stop the Steal, this post-Trump loss movement that they wanted to turn into a kind of coup. And he just said outright, we're not disavowing anyone. And that really resonated for me in November because I said, my God, if this is just an abandoned house now and they've ripped out all the wiring and they're just letting everybody in, all those soft barriers that had existed for a long time, even during the Trump era, this is underrated, it really did happen, between violent far-right extremists and mainstream Republican Party politics, the type of people who go to those grassroots type events, those you might associate with photographs of the Tea Party back in the day, that if there are no safeguards, if there are no walls between this could get very, very dangerous. And what happened was, for 2 months, we saw that, and then it culminated, hit a crescendo on the morning, the afternoon, really, of January 6th.
One of the things that several people have commented on is, and we've seen, troublesome, certainly, that's probably too mild a word, a number of people in these movements from law enforcement, with a law enforcement background or a military background, or still members of law enforcement departments or the military. What do you make of that?
I'm glad you asked about that. Well, the first thing, I'll just speak as a, as an American, I feel sad. It's extraordinarily discouraging. So let's just start with that, just as a human being. I don't think anything, I think, has bothered me more than that. And it's something we've tracked very closely at the center for a while. And what I make of it is, for a very long time, far-right extremists have valued military members as recruitments above almost anything else, and law enforcement.
Why?
And the reason why is the same thing I mentioned with the Oath Keepers about sizing up first responders to situations like this, being able to advise people on the ground in a chaotic situation like that, being able to make intelligence assessments, then secondarily also, understanding of weaponry and things like that. If you were preparing for sort of civil war apocalyptic situations, you need people who have that type of background, that type of experience. And I think the end result of that is we have, for years in this country, seen eroding trust in our overseas actions and eroding trust in our law enforcement from many people in the public, and sometimes for very, very understandable reasons. And seeing people who are out there, either white supremacists or doing this type of organized violence with white supremacists, is guaranteed to further erode that trust. And again, once again, for reasons that I think are pretty clearly understandable. And what I think we need to do is, we are late to the party here, is begin looking at this in a much more serious way. The center talks about, for the military, for example, they say, oh, what are you going to do when you find out somebody is a neo-Nazi with Adam Waffen division? What do? You just cut them loose from the Marines? Well, then you cut, you know, or he's interested in that. Well, then their likelihood of going directly to a hate group is that much more strong. So we need to be able to get people help while they're still in the military, right? There has to be people who have to be able to have the intelligence to be able to identify symbols, tattoos, and things like that, and see warning signs or events and get people help. I have talked to many formers who've come to me as sources later in life, and their lives have been utterly destroyed by this stuff. People who have had the courage to get out, just totally destroyed, families destroyed, future incomes destroyed, things like that, and under tremendous amount of strain. When you couple that with things like law enforcement and military, I feel like the after effect on them, not to mention the public, which we just discussed, is just that much worse. It's really just a sad thing for the country. I hope we do better.
On that point, let's take a quick break, and we've got lots more to get to here. Our guest, Michael Edison Hayden, is with the Southern Poverty Law Center. He is the senior investigative reporter and spokesperson for the Southern Poverty Law Center. This is the Bill Press Pod. We'll take a quick break, and we'll be right back. And today's podcast is about those extremist groups that are proliferating across the United States, brought to you by the United Food and Commercial Workers Union. Under the leadership of President Mark Perron, 1.3 million members of the UFCW. They're the ones who work in our great retail chain stores, our grocery stores, our chemical plants, cannabis plants, and the meat and poultry processing plants. We thank them for their great work and their support of the Bill Press Pod. Check out their website at ufcw.org.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
And we're back with Michael Edison Hayden, senior investigative reporter and spokesperson for the Southern Poverty Law Center. So, Michael, one of the groups that's gotten the most attention we haven't even talked about yet, they seem to be in a category of their own. What's the story with QAnon? I mean, what are they, as weird as it seems? What do they really believe, and how big are they? How dangerous are they?
So I guess the first question is, are they a group? I think is the question. It's sort of like, you have to rethink everything sort of philosophically kind of about when you see QAnon, because just the degree to which the conspiracy theory is pervasive, it's extraordinarily dangerous. And I know that there have been a lot of stories recently about the degree to which QAnon supporters, and we can get into what they believe in a second, mm-hmm. have become, are reckoning with the fact that many of the predictions, the sort of doomsday cult type predictions, or reverse doomsday cult, actually, it's about, Trump wins and everything happens, the clock on that has expired and now they're reckoning with it or whatever. I have 100% confidence that if QAnon does sort of, as we know it, disappear, it will reform as something else. It is extremely pervasive. There have been studies that suggest that half of the Republican people who vote Republican have some sort of idea from the QAnon conspiracy theory they believe in. I mean, that's just, wow. It's incredibly dangerous. It is the cause of kind of the intellectual rot of conservative journalism and the conservative media for so long. Again, it's a very tragic situation. They have just allowed social media to kind of overtake any kind of standards or practices that they had in the past.
Do they really believe that the Democratic Party is run by a bunch of pedophiles?
Yes.
Jesus, based on what?
There is some debate about this from people who have researched QAnon. I'm going to tell you my version of it. At the close of the 2016 election, many pro-Trump activists online pushed this conspiracy called Pizzagate.
Yeah.
Right? A most prominent of which is a far-right extremist named Jack Posobiec. Another one is Michael Cernovich. Both of them involved in different ways in the Stop the Steal movement, by the way. Both of them in different ways connected to Roger Stone. Pizzagate posited, based upon, it was a way to kind of make something of not much from John Podesta's hacked emails that were published by WikiLeaks and circulated heavily on Twitter and Facebook. Mm-hmm. And it sort of proposed this fantasy that Hillary Clinton and her allies and Democratic Party allies had created a pedophilia dungeon in the basement of a pizza place called Comet Ping Pong in Washington, D.C., a place that is haunted by this conspiracy theory now for 5 years. Just a week ago, they had people protesting outside it, no pedophilia, whatever. I mean, just incredibly sad what's happened to this business. In December of 2016, a guy comes up from North Carolina, I believe, and goes into the Comet Ping Pong with a gun.
Right.
And fires it in there. And he's looking for this pedophilia dungeon that I think the cynical activist that promoted this lie always knew was not there. I suspect these are very cynical operatives, in my opinion. And that really derailed Pizzagate as we knew it. And it didn't go away, but that energy needed to go into something new. And this conspiracy theory called The Storm is how it was first called, but then later became better known as QAnon. Started on 4chan and 8chan, where this guy who is supposedly like talking from inside knowledge of the Trump administration, some believed he was Trump himself or whatever, was giving this secret information about this storm that was coming that would be like lead to a series of arrests and prosecution of the people, the kind of cast of characters who serve as villains in the pro-Trump landscape. Hillary Clinton, Huma Abedin, one of her mm-hmm. personal friends and advisors, people like that, Podesta, Obama, of course, these sort of coded dispatches to QAnon supporters became bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And it started to almost get completely out of control. There were people like Jack Posobiec, for instance, who I mentioned, who are associated with Pizzagate, who ran segments on One America News, of all places. Obviously conspiracy associated with all kinds of right-wing conspiracy, trying to debunk it. So I really think that people were trying to control this thing, and it just was not getting controlled. And its believers had really rabid beliefs about Democratic officials being pedophiles, Hillary Clinton wearing faces of severed faces of people in satanic rituals, just stuff that you don't want to believe that people believe, but they did. And I think that people were really reluctant to catch on to just how pervasive this was. And it's, of course, we saw it present at the Capitol that day when right. people tried to, pull an insurrection.
Okay, well, in terms of how far this has gone, now we talked about members of the military or members of law enforcement. Now we have New York Times this morning, when we're talking this day, has identified four members of Congress, one of whom, Marjorie Taylor Greene, is a QAnon supporter, a member of Congress from Georgia. Paul Gosar from Arizona, who's appeared at Proud Boys events. Andy Biggs from Arizona appeared at events with the Oath Keepers. Lauren Boebert from Colorado appearing with the Three Percenters. I mean, these organizations now, they're not just influencing Congress, they're sitting in the United States Congress.
Yes, they are. I mean, and I wish the Times had been a little bit earlier on this, in the sense that we have been trying to sound the alarm about some of these figures for a long time. But I mean, I guess it took an insurrection for everybody to take it that seriously. We have been fighting to try to get people to pay attention to this for a long time. And I understand why there has been a bit of a delay in covering this stuff very seriously. I am sympathetic to it. It seems insane. And there are so many life and death issues that we all face right now. I mean, climate change that are not getting, enough attention. There's so much. And of course, the pandemic, my God, right? So I'm glad we're paying attention to this now. My concern is that now they're already in the door and it's very late. Gosar has been saying unhinged things for a very long time. I don't know if you know this, but Gosar claimed that Charlottesville was kind of a false flag type operation that was staged by George Soros. I mean, this type of stuff was not I remember reporting on that before I came to SPLC. And, the same type of people on Twitter and social media retweeted it and whatever, but it never really sunk in, I think, at a national level what that's like. And you have Paul Gosar with Steve Bannon in Europe having meetings with extreme far-right European parties. This is really serious. This is not conservatism.
No. And by the way, you may be taking it seriously, and now maybe the New York Times is taking it seriously, but clearly the Republican leadership in Congress is not taking it seriously. Kevin McCarthy supports these people, supported them when they ran for office, and hasn't done anything about their extremist beliefs.
Yeah, I know. It's probably right below the military and police matter we talked about, and just in terms of things that I feel sad about.
It's good that Southern Poverty Law Center is on their case. Is the Department of Justice on their case? Clearly, they crossed the line into illegal activity. In my judgment, they did at some of the state capitals, but they certainly did on January 6th at the United States Capitol. What's the Justice Department do? Just look the other way?
I think that there has been a really delayed reaction in taking this stuff seriously, in part because, one, most of the people involved in this movement are white. We have to be serious about that.
Thank you, and you're right. I mean, white supremacy is the common thread of all these organizations, isn't it?
Yes. Second of all, the people involved in this type of radicalization, which I said is not so much in groups now, but also just in individuals and in one of two political parties in this country, which is the two political party system, is also, I think, creating some problems in this respect. The fact that these people are they're your uncle, they're your cousin, they're on your street, is also creating a huge delayed reaction in dealing with it. There's this deer in the headlights reaction where it just says, it can't be real. It can't be my uncle. It can't be my cousin. It can't be my mother. In some cases, we've heard stories, right? So the first time I ever really saw the FBI taking far-right extremism extremely seriously during the Trump era was in the immediate aftermath, if you recall. So many things have happened across this time, but in the immediate aftermath of the August 3rd terror attack, August 3rd, 2019, El Paso terror attack, in which a young man allegedly came and killed about two dozen people in an El Paso Walmart, really in the name of this anti-immigrant ideology, this using the same type of talking points in his alleged manifesto that you see from these anti-immigrant nonprofits that advise people, including the president at that time. And then there were a flurry of arrests of people who were plotting attacks in synagogues, hospitals, all kinds of different places in the immediate aftermath of that. And they did not get very much attention. But there were, I just remember just so many, seeing like a new one every few weeks in the immediate aftermath of that, because I think there was a wake-up call that, like, you know, oh my God, these guys are really mobilizing and they're going to do terror attacks. With the QAnon stuff, a flurry of arrests, but also this kind of, okay, well, hopefully Trump will leave and then we'll get this sort of back to normal, I think was the attitude. It seems like Department of Justice is now catching up to that. There have been different charges recently, one of which was a very interesting one. I don't know if you saw this, but a guy named Douglas Mackey, whose stage name was Ricky Vaughn, who was recently charged for election charges related to election interference for doing a kind of, and I mentioned this because it is related, to doing a kind of social media rigging operation where he was convincing people to vote, to waste away their vote. And basically 5,000 people ultimately did by, you know, texting in their vote based upon these false things that he was putting, this fake news. It seems like the coalition of anti-democratic, and I'm just going to do this in a broad sense, anti-democratic, hard right, pro-authoritarian movement that came around with Trump that unified both extreme accelerationist neo-Nazis and also just these hard right Trump supporters, they are finally starting to mobilize and do something about it. And then now the question is it too late? Is it too dug into our politics? We have to hold out hope that it is not.
Let me ask you just a couple of final, real quick questions, real quick answers, if we can, okay?
Yeah.
Number one, we've been talking about extremist groups on the right. Are there an equal number of groups as dangerous a number of groups on the left?
No, and it's not particularly close. Absolutely, without question, people with a left-wing anarchist ideology who are connected to the so-called Antifa movement, did violence during the Trump era. So that cannot be disputed. Somebody sucker punched Richard Spencer in the side of the head, for example, during J20. There's a famous incident where a guy cracked somebody in the head with a bike lock, and just constant weekend scuffles between anarchists and extreme far-right figures. But the dialogue about Antifa has been presented by extreme far-right figures. One of them is Jack Posobiec of One America News, for instance, who very early on in that process was promoting conspiracy theories and deliberate lies about Antifa, that they derailed a train, that they they did the Sutherland Springs mass shooting, one of many mass shootings we forgot. All these things were made up in order to inflate the threat of Antifa and create some idea of both sides do it in order to keep that Overton window, that's so to speak, that world of far-right extremism moving hard, meet that train moving to the hard far-right under the guise that both sides do it, both sides are a problem, et cetera. There is nothing comparable to the El Paso shooting or the Tree of Life terror attack in Pittsburgh that has come out of the left in recent years. It has to be established as a fact and not some kind of partisan issue.
All right. Secondly, Trump is gone. He's no longer in power. Does that mean that all of these right-wing extremist groups then fold up their tent and go away, or just the opposite?
What I think is, and I'm sort of predicting here, so I am not entirely certain that groups will be in great shape. The idea of groups will be in great shape going forward under Biden, as if law enforcement ramps up things and they start looking for different ways to prosecute these guys that they're going to be under whatever. What I am more concerned about is this rhetoric around the Second Amendment and the First Amendment, the amendments that so-called patriot, constitutional, whatever, those are the ones they know. And those are the ones that they are unifying people around right now, mobilizing, creating kind of feelings of solidarity among different sectors of far-right extremists. That's what I'm more concerned about, because what we saw on January 6th, again, was not like Charlottesville, where there was these uniformed different groups with shields and things like that. There was a little bit of that. And then there were also these kind of randos who were, you know, in their like T-shirts advertising a civil war, that's a strange Camp Auschwitz sweatshirt that everybody has been horrified by, understandably so. What I am concerned about is that this mob is kind of just a floating sea in the country right now, mm-hmm. and can be unified under an authoritarian, cynical, hard right politician who is not Trump, who can just at a whim go back, dial into this, and you know, say like, you know, Mitt Romney, he's got to go. All these, you know, people in the Republican Party who are down say that they got to go. You go with me. And then we have this kind of unified neo-fascist movement in the country. And that is, I think, in the coming years, the thing that scares me the most.
And the final question, do you consider domestic terrorism today in this country as big a threat as foreign terrorism?
A bigger threat.
For all the reasons that we've talked about.
A bigger threat. And I don't take things like groups like ISIS lightly either. I just want to make that very clear. They are always a threat and extraordinarily scary, but we have to wake up to what we're seeing around us. This is not normal. Tree of Life terror attack, El Paso, this is not normal. What we saw in Charlottesville is not normal. I don't know how many wake up calls we really need.
And what we saw on January 6th is not normal. Michael Edison Hayden, thank you so much, Michael. First of all, thank you and all your people, your friends at the Southern Poverty Law Center for the great work you've done over the years. And thank you in particular for your good work and for joining us today on the Bill Press Pod.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. A really nice conversation.
And that's it for today's podcast on right-wing extremist groups. Now, this week, there's going to be a lot going on at the U.S. Capitol for sure. All the debate over the new stimulus bill, $1.9 trillion, that Joe Biden has asked for. All the debate over what to do about Marjorie Taylor Greene from Georgia. So there'll be a lot of fodder for our roundtable this Friday. Be sure to come back on the Bill Press Pod for Friday's roundtable. And in the meantime, stay safe, stay strong, stay sane, if possible, in the days of the pandemic. And come back and see us here on the Bill Press Pod next time on Friday.